Hi friends, welcome back to another episode of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails with Jen and Vanessa.
Please be advised, the following episode is for mature audiences only. We talk about content that may be triggering to some individuals and contain discussions regarding rape, murder, sex, suicide, religious organizations, and disturbing situations.
Now, let's get into this week's episode. So Jen, do you want to give our listeners any updates on your life this week?
Pretty much my life this week has only been work, so I don't have any updates. Yeah, I don't have anything.
Wow, you live such a fun life. I'm just kidding. I know you've
corporate been... America is amazing.
Yes, it is. I guess. Not really.
What about you?
So I made an awful, awful past decision, but tomorrow I am signed up for a St. Patrick's Day 5K.
Oh, no.
And, you know, spring forward, and I have to be there at 7:30 a.m. to run 3 miles.
So does that mean it's actually probably 6:30?
So, no, it was at 8:30.
So it is
7:30. So I made a really bad mistake with my life. You guys be thinking about me when you're listening to this, because I'll probably already suffer through, but it was a bad decision on my part.
Yeah, that sounds horrible. And it's supposed to rain tomorrow.
It's supposed to rain and be cold.
It was crazy. We were talking earlier this week with some coworkers about how last year this was the week that we shut down our office for COVID.
Oh, it was.
So now it's been an entire year.
Oh, happy COVID-versary.
So it's a COVID-versary, which is crazy. And we're actually opening our office back up on Monday.
Like full capacity?
Yep. So it's going to be really interesting for Indy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, for this week, I decided that I wanted to talk about something that I have not covered before. Obviously.
Hopefully. We listen to the same story again. I'll be like, all right, you got a different view. Let's do it.
Right. Japan is known for their low crime rates. Our story starts with Sako. Sako was always described as a gentle person by her family and friends. After graduating from junior high school, she went to a dressmaking school. People had attempted to arrange a marriage to a man for her living far away, but she declined because she couldn't look after her parents if she moved.
Good for her, independent woman.
Right? She knows what she wants, and she is not compromising.
Exactly. Good for you, girl.
On March 19th, 1995, the day before work, just like any other day, she spent the day with her family and was with her eldest brother, gave her nephew a backpack because he was about to enter elementary school. So then I think, just shows she's really into family. Yeah. She's very giving. Sako's a really good person.
Yeah.
7:45 a.m., which is around most of the time people are riding the subway. At 8 a.m., a man on her subway car put the end of his umbrella near a container that was wrapped in paper and then left the train. She would never fully recover. Sako would be bedridden for the rest of her life and suffer every single day. She lost her sight, and she had severe language impairment. After being hospitalized for 8.5 years, she moved to her brother's home where she spent most of her time just listening to music. Only way for her to even just say that she liked the music was to shake her entire body when she liked a song.
Wait, did you just say she was in the hospital for 8.5 years?
8.5 years.
Holy shit. Does Japan have, what is it called, like nationwide healthcare coverage? Because in America, I know that...
That would be expensive.
You couldn't even, like, do anything.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, actually.
Isn't that sad? That's just... First thing I think of.
Do they have universal health care?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, poor lady.
Yeah. And if someone even brought up the March 20th, 1995 subway ride that she had that morning, her face would contort in an uncomfortable position and she would reach for her eyes as if they were in pain.
Oh.
And after 25 years of suffering every single day, she passed away in the hospital last year. I guess they had to bring her back to the hospital in 2020.
Oh my gosh. That poor thing. Who is this man? Let's find him.
Right. Sako wasn't the only person that suffered on the subway that day. In fact, 13 people died on the subway.
Oh my gosh.
How fast did this happen? Well, one widow said that her husband, and again, I'm sorry for the mispronunciations. I'm really horrible with names, especially with people I'm not familiar with. So one widow said that her husband, Kazuma Takagashi, was a high member of the staff on the subway, so he was pretty high up. He actually picked up the container on the subway that was leaking and wiped up the liquid in the subway car. The attack happened again between 7:45 and 8 a.m., and she was to the hospital by 11:30, and his body was, quote, already cold by then.
Oh, he was right there next to it, so he got, like, the whole effect. Oh, no.
Of the people that were on the subway that day, 1,000 experienced vision problems, and over 5,500 people have issues of different degrees.
They can fit that many people on the subway?
This wasn't the only subway that was affected.
Oh, no.
Later, investigators discovered that it wasn't just one subway car, but it was actually five.
Oh, my gosh.
That had these containers with people that had these umbrellas.
So it's not just one man.
Right. It is not. So investigators found on the subway that there was these plastic bags, and they were covered with paper. That's my icebreaker.
Like, oh, no, we're being broken into.
And that container carried a substance called sarin.
Sarin. Okay.
S-A-R-I-N.
Okay.
So what's sarin, you ask? Well, it's a human-made chemical, and it was actually made by the Nazis.
Oh, okay. So we got Nazi gas.
When I looked on the CDC website, this is what they said about sarin exposure. A lot of people don't know that they're exposed to it because it doesn't have an odor. Showing these signs and symptoms doesn't necessarily mean someone's been exposed to sarin. It could be something else, but when they've had tests about sarin, this is what has been discovered.
Well, yeah, and there are so many people that were experiencing the same thing on the subway. Like,
right.
It has to be that.
Studies show that the long-term effects are pretty much people can either have brain damage or they're just less likely to survive. Mild exposure, people usually recover.
Okay. This sounds like a Nazi gas.
Right.
Oh my God.
I would just wanted to put this in there because it was on the CDC's website. If you ever are exposed to sarin or you think that you might be exposed to sarin, and I think this is for any other chemicals as well, this is what you should do.
Okay.
Leave the area where the chemical was released on you and get to fresh air. If you're in the subway car that day, or if you even feel like, you know, you're near something, get out and get to fresh air as soon as possible. If it's exposed on your body and it gets on your sweatshirt, cut the clothing off. Do not take it over your head.
Oh, yeah. You don't want it all up in your nostrils.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's just like in high school chemistry. If it gets anywhere near your eyes, anything on your skin, try to wash it off as quickly as possible.
Gotcha.
So as soon as this happened, authorities, of course, began investigating the incident. I mean, they had thousands of people flocking to the hospitals and deaths happening. So authorities began investigating the incident, and they saw connections between the subway attack and earlier incidents. There was another sarin attack that happened a year prior. There were rumors going around that it was by the Shinko, which I'm just going to call Om for the rest of the episode because, again, it's a lot to
gotcha,
say.
Gotcha, yep.
This means the supreme truth. The sarin attack that happened a year prior was in the residential area of Matsumoto. The reason that this group had even brought sarin into this residential area was because there were three judges that were going to rule in a lawsuit about a real estate dispute that they were that their group was having with another person.
So you're going to sarin them because of a real estate dispute?
They had access to sarin, and they wanted to also test the efficiency of it.
Oh my God.
They were manufacturing it with people in their group. And there was also another reason that they wanted to test it out in this area. Residents of this city had also angered the group because they opposed the group's plan to set up an office and a factory in that city. Just to be exact, the people in the city signed a petition that had over 140,000 signatures, pretty much saying that they didn't want them to open this office here, which is 70% of the population of that city.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. This group decided to target a three-story apartment building, which is where the judges lived. At 10:40 p.m., members of Om use a converted refrigerator truck to release a cloud of sarin. The cargo truck held like a heating contraption in order to help change it into a gas. By 11:30 p.m., the police were already called because people in that area were being transported to the hospital with symptoms that we described earlier.
Yeah.
A total of 274 people were treated with this incident.
I was going to say, you're targeting these three judges, but you're letting it up in the air, so all these people are going to be affected by it.
Yeah, five people actually died in their apartments, and two died in the hospital after admission.
Oh my gosh.
Someone else, an eighth victim, Sumo Kono, remained in a coma for 14 years and died in 2008.
Did they ever wake up? Do we know that?
We do not. The day after the attack, people were still finding dead animals near the building.
Oh, no. Do not tell me there's a dead cat. Do not tell me that.
Specify. And that's when the forensic team decided to use this really cool thing that I just found out about called gas chromatography. pretty much is this like awesome test that reveals what the poison was, and they discovered it was sarin.
Wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So just because the authorities knew that, again, these judges were about to rule on this case, has had their hand in scientific research. They kind of connected the dots, but they couldn't do anything to prove that they were involved in the attack.
Right.
So it was one of those things where they thought they might be affiliated with them, but they weren't sure. So after the subway incident, police actually raided Om's offices in Tokyo and their lab headquarters in another city that's very close that's spelled K-A-M-I-K-U-I-S-H-I-K-I.
You're not going to pronounce it?
Kamukuishiki.
There it is.
See, that's how bad I am at pronouncing, ladies and gentlemen.
Shocking.
Skip forward to May, and Om's leader, Ashara Shoko, and other leaders that were part of this cult were disputing that they didn't have any involvement in these attacks. Authorities were still on the search to physically find their leader, Ashara, and he was found 2 months later. So pretty much like what happened with Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, that's what I was going to compare it to.
Yeah. Yeah. Hidden rooms, which I didn't really know that was a thing, but apparently it is.
Did they make a movie about it too?
Not yet. So after they get the leader and they put him in jail, some of the followers start admitting that they were involved in the attacks. It was reported later that the 5 men that were responsible for leaking gas on these subway cars, they were told that the only way to save the world from going to hell was for them to do this and kill these people.
They were told that by the leader?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. Let's get forward to the court case. There was a lengthy trial that spanned years, like everyone does, but the court didn't believe him. But the Japanese public was very, very angry. I would be angry too. This was a huge thing that happened to their entire well-being and their transit system. I wouldn't even feel comfortable riding the subway ever again.
No!
So the court didn't give him an evaluation.
What do you mean they didn't give him an evaluation? Like
he claimed insanity, and the court did not.
They didn't even have like a psychiatrist or nobody?
They didn't. Because they were afraid if there was any type of indication that he was insane, the public was going to go crazy.
Oh.
They sentenced him to death. He was executed via hanging on July 6,
2018. I told you about those hangings in Japan.
Right. 23 years after the attack.
Wow. Why did it take 23 years? Is it just the same thing? Like,
I'm assuming
America?
It's the same as America.
Wow.
Japan is still seen as peaceful, but this attack obviously made people more feel fearful. And a lot of people said they still haven't recovered from the PTSD from riding the subway.
I wonder if there's still people that like were on that subway that day and are still living.
Is. Like there was thousands of people that had those mild symptoms.
Oh, I guess. Yeah.
But then, you know, they recovered.
Wow.
3 OM members wanted in connection with the cult's crimes remained fugitives for more than a decade and a half. The first one, Harada Makoto, surrendered to Tokyo police at the end of 2011. Second one, Kikuchi Nako, the second of the 3, was arrested in early June 2012. Less than 2 weeks later, Tahashi Kasuya was apprehended in Tokyo. He was the most wanted out of everyone because he was Ashara's bodyguard, and he was suspected of driving one of the getaway cars from the subway attack.
So he went around to all the subways or just like
one? Just one of them.
Okay. It wasn't like a Uber getaway car, right? Okay,
cool. So this cult, they taught that there was a global conspiracy going on that was going to lead to world war, and there was going to be a nuclear Armageddon. Only the followers of Om, of course, would survive in this new kingdom that they were about to build.
Of course they would.
So next week, we're going to talk about all their beliefs and why it happened, but I wanted to start off with how it ended.
That's good. Ooh, I like, what is that? A literary... Some kind of writing style that I have no idea about because I'm awful at English and grammar. But that was awesome. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So next week, we're going to talk about why they believe what they do.
Oh, I hate them so much, though.
Me.
Poor
too.
Lady at the beginning. God. Ugh.
Hey, Jen here with this week's cocktail. And since it's St. Patrick's Day, I just wanted to share a green one that you could do with all of your friends and one that you probably won't have to go to the liquor store in order to put together. So for this, for the mimosa, we're going to do champagne, Prosecco, or whatever you just like to drink.
And then you're also going to have your orange juice, just like any other regular mimosa. I like pulp-free, but that's completely up to you. You can also substitute pineapple juice if you want to. That works pretty well, but it'll be greener if you do use orange juice and blue curacao. So obviously, all you need to do is mix the orange juice, champagne, and then just add a splash of blue curacao, and it is going to turn green just because of the orange and the blue mixed together. So yeah, super easy. Probably something you already have in your liquor cabinet and something that you can just do on the fly, and you don't have to buy a ton of ingredients, and you still have something green to drink for St. Patrick's Day. Be safe out there, guys, and have a happy St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patty's Day is coming up in a few days. I think it's on Wednesday this year.
Right.
So I wanted to do a Irish serial killer.
Love it.
Got to fit themes, right? So I'm going to tell you a story, but I'm not going to tell you who yet. At around 3 p.m. on August 3rd, 1983, Detective Ian Brown was experiencing a normal day at the London jail that he worked at. People had been in and out all day, and it was a typical Wednesday. Around this time, two men were being escorted by an officer to their cell. Apparently, these two men were homeless drunks who had just been caught stealing a watch and a wedding ring from an elderly man in the park. And apparently, their claim as to why they robbed him was to get money for their next boozy drink.
Okay.
So, a fun little tidbit. The drink of choice for a lot of homeless people back then was called a Red Biddy. It is a cocktail that is mixed with cheap wine and a methylated spirit.
Okay.
So if you don't know what a methylated spirit is, it's basically like rubbing alcohol.
Ew.
Yeah. It's 90% ethanol, which is what we know as drinking alcohol. And it's 10% methanol, which is a toxic alcohol that can actually make you blind. They won't sell pure ethanol for like peroxide or like rubbing alcohol, because then you wouldn't have to buy expensive vodka. That's like super taxed up. So basically, they bought this at the drugstore because it was super cheap, but they were taking a chance of being poisoned. So, you know, you got to weigh your odds on that, which is 100,000% why I did not want to be in charge of the cocktails this week. So anyway, the men were thrown into a cell with another drunken homeless man who was sound asleep, sobering up from his alcohol intake during the day. And you could tell he was sound asleep by his jet plane-like snoring. In London, this was a pretty common thing at the time. Basically, they were being put into the drunk tank, and they were going to be charged with a minor theft. As this is nothing special, after the two men get all booked and they get into their jail cell, it's around 5 p.m., so it's time for Detective Brown to go home. He's getting ready to walk out the door when all of a sudden he hears screaming and banging from the other jailmates, telling him to come quick. As Brown rushes over to see what the hell is the cause for all this ruckus, he sees a guard giving CPR to an inmate. The inmate had a pair of socks tied around his neck as if he had been strangled. Brown looks at the other two inmates that were sharing the cell with the most likely deceased man. One inmate is screaming erratically at the top of his lungs, begging to be let out of the jail cell. The other, however, is sitting calmly on the bed with no socks on. Huh.
I wonder who did it.
This sockless inmate was named Kieran Kelly. So who is Kieran Kelly? He was born on March 16, 1930, in a city on the outskirts of Dublin, Ireland, but his family ended up moving to Dublin in his childhood. So he was 53 years old at the time of the jailhouse murder. He had the nickname of Nosy Kelly growing up that continued into adulthood for his small figure and his large nose.
Poor guy.
I know. But I mean, how unique are you, Nosy Kelly? Other than that, he really didn't have anything out of an ordinary childhood. I mean, they weren't well off, and his father and mother had several other children to take care of. So Kelly ended up joining the army at age 18. So this was in 1948. That did not last long, because 3 years later in 1951, he was kicked out after going absent without leave in Dublin for an entire year.
A year.
And they waited till a year after. It'd be like, oh, we probably should kick you out.
Yeah, that's too nice.
Yeah, exactly. After he gets dishonorably discharged, he decides to, you know, become a criminal. He's in and out of jail for the next 9 years for breaking into houses and robbing them. In 1961, at 31 years old, he meets an Irish woman in England and then decides to marry her. She already had 5 kids, and this was not common back in the 60s to marry another woman with so many kids. But nonetheless, Kelly stepped up to the plate and became Stepdad of the Year. He even had 2 kids of his own with his newlywed wife.
Aw.
Yeah, cute. So he even stepped up and he got a real job outside of his criminal record. So now, I mean, he's kind of basically got a normal life.
Yeah.
He's got a wife, a family, a job that was not long lived. 3 years into their marriage in 1964, it ends up failing, resulting in divorce. After the divorce, Kelly went into a downward spiral. He went back to breaking into houses and robbing them. His alcohol intake dramatically increased. He was in pubs every day, drinking himself from sunrise to sunset. So basically like a Fred Gallagher.
Right.
So in 1969, he ended up in a psychiatric hospital after attacking a woman with a knife in her own home. And 2 years later, he was released because the mental institution claimed that there was, quote, nothing we could do for him.
Wow.
So might as well just let him go, right?
That makes zero sense, but okay.
Right. Exactly. So back to current events, we're back in the jail cell. This is 12 years after being released from the psychiatric hospital. Detective Brown is a little confused about Kelly and what would bring him to do this. So doing a little digging on Kelly, Brown finds that he was tried for a murder of a man named Ed Toll a few years prior in 1977. Toll was also a homeless man who one night was sleeping on a gravestone that Kelly claimed was his. So
pretty sure it's not because you're alive, but okay.
It's not. And like, yeah, you're not dead. So whatever. Kelly got enraged by this. So he took some rope that was holding up his pants and he strangled Toll with it. And there were multiple witnesses to this as Kelly was walking away. One even exclaimed, "Hey, I think you killed him, man." Kelly then supposedly looked at the men, looks back at Toll, who was just strangled, turns back and walks towards him and re-strangles him. Then he turns back to the men and responds, "Now I have."
Wow.
So he's got some balls. However, when they go to trial, he's found not guilty because the witnesses were homeless drunks as well. And there was no evidence of Kelly killing him.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So I guess like he took the rope and like got rid of the evidence. So to get to know Kelly a little better as to what would bring him to commit such a heinous act, Brown goes into the interrogation room and casually asks Kelly to tell him about the murder. To which Kelly responds, "Which one?" Brown doesn't reply to Kelly, but just kind of stares at him. After a few seconds of silence, Kelly exclaims, "Oh, you're talking about Fisher, aren't you?" Brown had no idea who Fisher was. So he tells Kelly, BRB, and leaves the interrogation room to do some more digging. Brown found a file on a man named Hector Fisher, who was an alcoholic homeless man as well. On July 19, 1975, he was found beaten to death with an iron bar behind a church. So Brown comes back in the room and he says, "Okay, spill. Why'd you kill him?" And he says, "Fisher wanted my ass." Kelly knew about evidence at the scene that would only be known if he were at the actual crime scene himself. So, for example, Kelly said that he made it look like a robbery and he left £40 in his pocket, so $40. And he tried to make it look like a robbery gone wrong. Around the time the cops showed up, Kelly was actually questioned twice since he was in the area. He was still wearing the same clothes that he had killed him in, and he had blood stains on the clothes, but he was wearing a red jumper, so he wasn't sure if the police actually saw the stains or not.
Wow.
The cops ended up coming back a couple of hours later, and Kelly said that they tried to question him for a third time, but he denied everything, and by this time, he was in a new outfit.
So, I mean, I would too. As soon as the cops come the first time, I would be changing.
But yeah, but it's crazy how they just came back like later, and they're like, "Oh, we're going to question you again." But
why'd you change?
Why'd you got a new wardrobe, buddy? I like your shirt. The police let him go. And when Kelly ended up telling this story to Brown, he said, "I was too clever for you." So Brown basically says, "Okay, if you're too clever for us, what else do you want to tell us? What else did we miss?"
Yeah, why confess now?
Exactly. And this is where Kelly starts rambling. Buckle up. It's a lot. Get your thinking caps on. So what Brown thought was going to be an open and shut case turned into a long 2-week interrogation.
2 weeks.
That's a long time for an interrogation. By the end of this, Brown kind of got to know Kelly. He knew how he liked his tea. Like, that's just how many hours they spent together.
Right.
So the next murder he confesses to is killing a man named Christy Smith back in 1953, and he claims it was the one that started it all. First, I want to say that Christy in Ireland is a short name for Christopher, so no one is confused. It is, he killed a male, not a female, or however Christy identified. This was during the time of him being dishonorably discharged from the army before he met his wife. AKA, this was 30 years ago, meaning that a murderer had been on the streets for 30 years.
Wow.
On August 3rd, 1983, Kelly and Smith were both underground at a subway in the evening hours of the Queen's inauguration. They had been drinking all day, celebrating with all of London, which apparently it's like a big party.
I feel like we're going to have to make a trip.
When's the next time the Queen's inaugurated? So the two men, Kelly and Smith, were walking with each other and kind of like having drunk fights with each other on and off. And all of a sudden, Smith says something to Kelly to really throw him over the edge. So in return, Kelly literally throws Smith over the edge of a platform into an oncoming train. If you're wondering why he wasn't caught, it was honestly common for a single man to go missing back then. His family honestly thought that he had left, made it big, and was living with his riches somewhere.
Wow.
Which, can you imagine your mom, like, just being like, oh, Jen just left.
That's so sad.
She's living with her riches somewhere.
So the body was just never identified then? And wow.
Essentially, these men were perfect victims. They were, quote unquote, nobodies. The next victim that Kelly confesses to is the murder of Mickey Dunn. Remember Edward Toll, who Kelly was on trial for and got not guilty?
Yes.
Mickey Dunn was one of the witnesses who said that he saw Kelly kill Toll.
Yeah, I would be staying away from him.
So it's safe to say that Kelly had a little bit of a grudge. He said that they were, of course, drinking together one night, and Kelly poisoned Dunn's drink with a ton of headache medicine.
They were drinking together?
Yeah.
I would not drink with someone I accused of murder.
Exactly. So that wasn't very smart on Dunn's part, but when Dunn fell asleep, Kelly smashed the bottle to destroy the evidence of the headache medicine. And he didn't actually see Dunn die, but he had sure hoped he had killed him. That's what he said in the interrogation. Dunn actually ended up being taken to the hospital shortly after and ended up dying there.
No.
Kelly continues on to confess more murders. He said he killed a man named Scotch Jack. He hit him in the head with an iron bar and then beat him to death and left him in a basement stairwell. There was an unsolved case of a man beaten to death, left in a basement stairwell of an abandoned house. Again, this was a nobody. He said he killed a man named Soapy Joe, who he had burned to death. He said he pushed two more guys off a platform, and one was named Francis Taylor, and he did not die. And Kelly actually got charged of attempted murder for this one.
At least he finally got charged with something.
Exactly. But he had witnesses, including a lawyer who was down in the subway station that saw Kelly push Taylor, and it still wasn't good enough because it was hearsay. He did it. No, I didn't.
Right.
And so he got off not guilty. Kelly then goes on to say he committed another murder where he poured whiskey down a guy's throat, making him choke to death. He held his head between his knees and pushed his chin down and like just kind of like poured the whiskey down his throat. Which, this also matched a homeless guy who police had found who had choked to death on some kind of liquid. So Brown is basically, you know, he has his jaw down to the floor by now. And he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why are you all of a sudden confessing to all these murders, like you had said? Kelly is quoted saying, it plays a toll on your mind after a while. You kill one person, you don't get caught. You kill another, same thing. It adds up.
It reminds me of like the weepy voice killer that was like, please catch me. Like when he was making phone calls to the police.
Yeah. Kelly also states at one point in the interview that he wanted credit for the murders. No one else.
Narcissist.
Mm-hmm. He didn't care about solving unsolved cases. He just wanted credit for when it's due, which, I mean, like you said, is narcissist. And, you know, all these serial killers want to be known as this is the person. That's why they have trophies and everything like that. So all in all, during the whole time span of the interview, Kelly confesses to 14 to 15 murders. So it's all over the place. They don't even have a definite number.
That's crazy.
And almost all the murders were completely unnoticed. So it sounds pretty, you know, open and shut, right? Kieran Kelly is not that simple. His case is probably one of the furthest from simple I've ever personally heard. So now we need to say, whoa, whoa, whoa. We are going to do some investigating on our part because that is a lot of murders to take responsibilities for. So put on your thinking caps and your analyzing caps and let's dive into this. So let's go back to the first murder, which was the prison cellmate. This is pretty open and shut. He was sockless on the bed. Like, he did it. The second murder we talked about was Edward Toll, which was the guy using Kelly's tombstone that he claimed as his. And he got off not guilty because there were no credible witnesses. Kelly didn't specifically talk about this case, so we can throw this one as like a 50-50. The third murder we talked about was Hector Fisher, which was the guy who was found beaten to death with an iron bar behind a church. Although Kelly knew about some of the evidence at the scene, the cops knew that he was at least exaggerating about the crime. For example, during confession, he said the bar was sharp on the ends, so he cut Fisher across his throat and he cut his ass. So there were slash wounds on his ass, but there were no slash wounds on his ass.
Got it.
So he was at least exaggerating about that, and he was actually stabbed multiple times rather than hit with an iron bar. So now it's like, okay, what else are you exaggerating about? Here's the big one. Christy Smith, aka his good friend that he pushed into a train. So if you were to type in Kieran Kelly's name into Google right now, you'll see a lot of articles stating that he was the London Underground serial killer. Like, that is what he is known for. Kelly gets this reputation from a man named Jeff Platt. Jeff was an officer on the case at the time that this was all happening. So Platt got to spend a lot of time with Kelly, transporting him to the court and back to jail multiple times. And he actually wrote a book about it because he said during this quality time together, Kelly confessed to even more things.
I'm sure he did.
Yeah. So first, Platt wrote that Kelly confessed he was gay.
Really?
And he said that it was the main reason that he killed Smith.
That makes zero sense.
So during the inauguration, they were talking, having fun, and apparently Smith asked Kelly, "Are you ever going to meet somebody and tie the knot?" Kelly then was supposedly internally freaking out. He had grown up in a Catholic school. Being gay was wrong. So he took this as Smith was saying, "I know what you're hiding, and it's a sin."
Right.
And that's why he pushed him over the edge in the subway. But we already know that Kelly was married to a woman in the 60s. And the fact that he is saying that he's gay in the 50s doesn't make sense.
Right.
So second, Platt wrote that Kelly confessed to killing many more men in the subway rather than just Smith. 31 total victims, in fact.
Wow.
Which is how he's getting the, you know, reputation as an underground serial killer. And he said that he targeted gay men because he hated them for what they were.
Open and able to live their life the way they wanted to?
Exactly. Freedom, you know. But he said that he would just kind of like walk up to these victims and Kelly would engage in a conversation with them. And then Kelly would be brushed off by these people. Like, I mean, I would brush off a drunk homeless guy coming up to me and talking to me.
Right.
And then Kelly would push him in front of the subway. From writing this book, this is where, you know, it got attention. There were people coming forward saying, "Hey, my best friend or father or whoever was at the subway the time that Kelly was active in London. The police said it was suicide, but we didn't believe it back then, and we don't believe it now."
Right.
It was basically giving people closure to, like, the loss of their loved ones. Like, they actually had a reason. They didn't commit suicide. They were pushed in front of a train by a serial killer. So Platt also wrote that he dug up articles on these suicidal victims, and Kelly would just happen to be a witness in several of them, and nobody connected to the dots. A journalist named Rob straight up asked, "So what made you so interested in Kieran Kelly?" To which Platt responds, "That's the one that caught my imagination." So Rob's like, "Huh, that's an odd response there." And he decides to do some digging. It turns out he calls City Hall to ask him if he could see some of these archive newspaper articles that Platt was talking about, and there were none to be found. He then asked Ian Brown, which now we're kind of like more in the present, but he asked Ian Brown when he was questioning Kelly about Platt. Brown says that back then he was not in a senior position to even talk about the case, which is why his job was literally just to drive Kelly back and forth to court in the jail cell. He wasn't even in the interrogation room at the time. He wasn't on any of the court paperwork. So Platt is the only person that Kelly confessed these murders to. No one else. So the journalist calls him out on his bullshit and asks him to clarify. To which Platt literally gets up, says, "We're done here," and walks away. And Rob never hears from him again.
Wow.
And a fun little tidbit, this book has awful reviews on Amazon, so I don't recommend buying it. But Kelly, to this day, has the reputation of an underground serial killer, when in fact, it was only one person that he pushed in front of a subway.
That's crazy.
Or was it?
You don't know. Nobody knows.
Rob investigated to see if Christy Smith even existed, or if this was part of Kelly's drunken imagination. It's a wild roller coaster ride of an investigation. I won't get into the nitty-gritty of it, but basically they searched high and low for Christy Smith, since it's such a common name. They find out that he did exist, but he did not die in 1953, as Kelly claimed. He died in 1955. They found out that Smith was working on train tracks, and he was witnessed by multiple people getting run over by a train by accident. Kelly didn't push him. Kelly didn't kill him. So after all that, the fourth murder that Kelly confessed to killing, we're going back to murders now, if you can even remember at this point, was Mickey Dunn on August 28th, 1982. Mickey was the one who he had poisoned with headache medicine that testified against Kelly for Edward Toll.
Right.
Although he ended up dying in the hospital, it was highly suspected that he was in the hospital in the first place due to Kelly poisoning him. However, on the death certificate, it said Dunn died of bronchial pneumonia and cryptogenic cirrhosis of the liver. So basically drinking all your life.
Right.
A liver specialist confirms that this cause of death is not caused by the reason that Kelly described. He died of his health condition. Kelly then goes on to admit, after being confronted of this, "Well, I guess I was drinking with Dunn a few days after I had poisoned him."
Seriously? Then you didn't do it right.
Then you didn't kill him. Obviously, if you're drinking with him a few days after you poison him. Although Kelly confesses to a few other random murders, we don't have the details about them, but we do have the details about the final murder he confessed to. The random guy that he poured whiskey down his throat and he choked to death. So if you recall, the police had a matching record from a homeless guy who had choked to death that had matched Kelly's story. So back to the interview room, Brown asked Kelly if this guy's name was Patsy Walters, which was the victim that the police had found. And Kelly's like, "Oh yeah, that's him." But Brown was playing him. Kelly was in prison at the time that Walters died. So Brown gets pissed off and he's like, "You're lying, tell the truth." To which Kelly responds, "I don't know his name. My brain is messed up. It's destroyed from the alcohol." An old friend of Kelly had heard about his sentencing and he honestly thought it was a great thing. He claimed that Kelly was a, quote, "nice guy, but when he drinks, he turns into a different person, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde," which we all know a few of those.
Right.
But even during the interview, Brown asked Kelly, "When you have a drink, you just don't give a damn, do you?" To which Kelly responded, "Yeah, I 100% believe that this is the case." For example, Brown reported during this 2-week interrogation that Kelly would act super sporadic. He would randomly get up and start shadowboxing.
Really? That's weird.
So he had basically lost his mind. Like, his mind was not anywhere near, I guess, non-alcohol ridden. But all in all, Kelly ends up being charged with only 2 counts of murder, 1 for Boyd and 1 for Hector Fisher. Although his mismatching wounds almost got him acquitted from those charges, because remember he said that he slashed him in the ass and there were no ass slashings. The rest of them, even if he did kill them, they were essentially nobodies in the London's police eye. They weren't too investigated into. In 1984, at the age of 54 years old, Kelly is sentenced to life in prison. He also stated that Kelly would be happy with prison life. Being homeless for so many years, he would have a bed at night. He would always have a meal. And regardless of the dangers of prison life, he'd at least be safe from the street.
Right.
He was escorted to Franklin Prison, which is where all the dangerous prisoners go. For example, Dr. Death also spent his time there, which I'm sure I'll cover him someday. But the thing is, since Kelly was such a regular to the jails, the governor of the prison was there, like, when he arrived to greet the newly dangerous prisoner. And Kelly smiled and literally said, "Hello, governor." Really? Like, that's how much of a regular he was.
Why would the governor even go there to be greeting people?
I don't know. But apparently that was a thing. So Kelly ended up dying in prison, I'm guessing of natural causes, at the age of 71 years old, which I'm surprised he lived that long, considering all of his past alcohol abuse. Although Kelly was a roller coaster of a ride, he did lead investigators to basically dust off the shelves of many unsolved London murders, especially train murders. So I guess that's like a half glass full perspective on it. But that is the story of Kieran Kelly, the not so underground serial killer.
Wow, that's crazy.
It's a roller coaster of a ride.
I just can't believe he, wow.
So I can mention this in my sources, and if you want, you can cut this out. But there is a podcast called The Nobody Zone.
Mm-hmm.
It is 8 episodes long and an hour long each. So this is 8 hours of content into about a half hour. They take a deep dive into everything, like finding out if Christy Smith existed, everything like that. So if you guys want to hear more details about it, I highly recommend the Nobody Zone podcast. One of the most confusing cases I've ever heard in my life, because you don't know what's real and what's not.
Right. Did he do it? Did he really not do it?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, he killed the prison cellmate.
That's the only one you know, though.
That's the only one. And then, like, his attempted murder, and, like, did he actually push another person in front? That's crazy.
Well, I love that one. That was good. And happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day. If you're running, pretend to be running. Hey everyone, Vanessa here to tell you about my sources for Kieran Kelly. I found out about Kieran Kelly on, of course, Murderpedia, and I got a couple of facts from the Irish Post and My London News, but honestly, I got most of my information from the Nobody Zone podcast. It is an 8-episode series. The episodes range from 40 to 50 minutes. It is a deep dive into Kieran Kelly's life, so by the end of it, you're going to know his social security number. Just kidding on that, you probably wouldn't get any money from it anyway, but honestly, if you want to go into a rabbit hole with Kieran Kelly, go check out that podcast. It is available on all streaming platforms. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Hey, guys. Jen here with my sources this week. I watched a documentary called Shrinko, The Chronological History Beyond the Dark Special on YouTube, and also Tokyo's Fateful Sarin Gas Attack in 1995, One Day That Changed Asia, off of YouTube. I also read articles regarding Tokyo Subway Attack of 1995, Facts, Background, and Om Shrinko off of Britannica. What lessons can we learn from the Japanese sarin attacks from pubmed.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov? Also, Matsumo Om Sarin Guinea Pig, the Japan Times. Also, Matsumo Om Sarin Guinea Pig, the Japan Times. Three major cases involving the Om Shrinko Doomsday Cult, the Japan Times. CDC, Facts About Sarin, Sarin Nerve Gas, The Om Shrinko, The New York Times, and that is it. Thank you guys for listening.